Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who go or don't go to church, and where we can meet and hear from those that have made their faith count. This podcast series is to encourage via conversation and not necessarily change your mind prior to listening. You can contact us as well, by the way. Email us, ogc@accessradio.biz, and biz is spelled B-I-Z. That's ogc@accessradio.biz. So please enjoy today's guest, who was in the police force for 30 years. We saw him on the beat in Cornwall before working in Plymouth and then moving into the training division, specialising in management and training support. Our guest later, with a friend, headed up Crosslink Transformation Network in Exeter. CTN connects Christians in the workplace in order for support and networking to be available. Whatever was a believer's ministry, our guest wholeheartedly believed in what their work was about in the public arena. Our guest has just had his book, Gateway to Destiny, published. So, what is Gateway to Destiny about? Why write about practically finding one's purpose in life? Why has he subsequently trained as a life coach? How did the question, what has God put the unique you on this earth now, to achieve? What were the problems he faced as a Christian and a police? All these questions gives me great pleasure to welcome to Off Grid Christianity, and that's Frank Bennett. Frank, thank you so much for joining us today. Obviously, we're going to find out a lot more about you in a minute or two, but for those that don't know where you live, where are you living currently, please, sir?
Yeah, great to see you, Martin. I'm living in a place called Ufcombe, which is about four or five miles north of Cullumpton in Devon, near Junction 27 of the M5.
And, of course, you are living in Cornwall as well, so no doubt all that will come out together with what goes on in Devon these days. But before we get there, five maybe not so important questions. Let's see how we get on. You never know where we might end up with these answers. So question number one then, please, good sir. If you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask them questions, who would it be?
Yeah, I had to think about this one for some time. I guess most Christians would say Jesus, but putting that to one side for a moment, it really would be, for me, St. Paul.
Uh-huh.
That might seem a little bit strange, but the thing about St. Paul for me was that how he was totally transformed from one thing to another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guy who started out as a persecutor of Jesus's followers was trying to round them up, lock them up, kill them even. But yet he met with God, met with Jesus, and he ended up becoming one of the greatest servants of Jesus and wrote so much of the New Testament. For me, he was an overcomer, a persister. And I think that's such a strong attribute, really.
Yeah. And of course, you could say, well, look, from my police background, you know, we had certain protocols on how to arrest people. You didn't, Paul. You know, you just went in, tell me more sort of thing. So that would have been a good interest to get it alone to ask him, I would have thought. What do you think he would have said to that?
Well, he got his authority from, obviously, the Sanhedrin and other of the Jewish leaders at the time. So he was still accountable, but there were very, very few safeguards on what he was actually doing. And by all accounts, he was so zealous that he would really hound people, hunt them down, persecute them.
Yeah.
So he was a very determined man.
Yeah. Whereas today, I'm sorry, I can't go in yet. I haven't got my shield on. I haven't got my shin pads on. I haven't got my riot gear on, all that sort of stuff. It might take about half an hour, by which time the crowd would have dispersed. Interesting. Question number two. Who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable?
Yeah, that was a relatively easy one for me. Favourite biblical story is in Daniel 3, you know, about the fiery furnace.
Yeah.
And how these three young Jewish lads who'd been taken into captivity, or were in captivity, Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, and how the king of the day was cajoled, if you like, by persecutors of Christians or Jewish believers at the time, to actually have to bow down and worship a statue.
Yes.
Under pain of death if they didn't. And the king signed up to the decree. And a little while later, Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego were brought before the king because they refused to bow down and worship foreign gods, foreign idols. And I just thought it was amazing how these three young guys, and they said that, they were just outspoken defiance of the king. They said to him, "We will not serve your gods." And I thought, three young men in the very early stages of their life who were prepared to say, "I'm not going to serve your gods. I believe in the one true God, and we're going to serve him."
Yes.
And I just thought that was such a strong thing to say. But then they knew the penalty. So the king got the fiery furnace heated up seven times hotter, and they were thrown into it. And the fact is, God met them in that fiery trial, and they came out of it unharmed, not even smelling the smoke. Just how God intervened, how the supernatural intervened into the natural life, I just thought was amazing.
And it's the sort of story we'd have heard all those years ago at primary school and Sunday school and everything else like that. But yes, thank you for explaining it more in more detail. Good answer. Question three. This could be interesting then. If you were Prime Minister, Frank, for the day and could change any law or impose new law, what would it be?
I'm not sure how popular this would be, Martin, but I would reverse Sunday trading.
Oh, really? No, you're not the first person to say this. Tell me more.
I remember a time back in my youth when there was, you know, when Sunday was a quiet day. It was very much a family day, but that all changed with the Sunday trading. And what I just see now is more and more families and people that are so stressed that Sunday is just as an active day. And to me, it's a very poor thing for society. We hear so much more about people saying, my mental health, yet we live and we're making ourselves work in a situation that's increasing those stresses all the time.
Yeah, and from that point of view, I think that is an excellent answer. And something you might actually get through, actually, if you're Prime Minister, because, you know, mental health is becoming more and more prevalent. MPs will be talking more and more about it because it's the subject of the hour, let's say, and quite rightly so it should be. So yeah, you might just get that through. Would you still allow little shops? Because that was some of the rules, wasn't it? Well, one of the rules. I think it was under certain square footage, you were allowed to open up on a Sunday morning, whatever, like news agents and stuff. Would you allow that to happen?
Yeah, I would, under very controlled circumstances, so it doesn't become a backdoor to trading on a Sunday all over again.
Obviously, because you're not too far from the coast, you would say then that if you're a seaside town or something like that, you might be allowed to open up the shops as well to sell all the stuff that tourists need.
To a very limited degree. I think that if you're not careful, you get the thin edge of the wedge and you end up coming back to where we are now,
which
I really don't think is helping society at all.
Go back to what it was in the 70s, I think you're saying, really.
Yeah, not far off.
As long as I can get me ice cream, I don't mind. Question number four. Outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out?
That would have been the 8th of October 2016, Martin.
Oh, okay, I'm trying to work out. Okay, what was I doing 2000? What were you doing 8th of October 2016?
For the very first time, watching England play at Wembley.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've been a football fan for years, but I'd never never got around to seeing England. And together with my youngest son, who was keen on football, we went up to Wembley, watching England play Malta in a friendly.
Wow.
That was brilliant. Really loved it.
Brilliant. Yeah, of course, from Plymouth, that is some hike. And I have to always doff my cap seeing the Plymouth Argyle Supporters Club coaches going up, because you've got like an hour and a half, nearly 2 hours, just to get to Bristol when civilization actually begins. And then you've got to go further on as well. All those Plymouth Argyle fans that have to go to Carlisle United on a cold Tuesday night, you know, major, major respect. And I'm glad you went to England. Yeah, I've had the privilege of doing that many a time and following them abroad as well. It really is a great day. What do you remember most about it, apart from the football match?
Just the logistics of getting there, as you said. We had to leave in good time. I drove up, parked on the outskirts of London, and then trained in. But just being around that atmosphere, seeing the ground fill up bit by bit, and England winning, of course, that obviously made it a really good day.
Yeah,
it's fantastic. But the crowd being inside, it wasn't a full, but 70,000 people, which I've not been in a crowd like that at Exeter, because we only get 8,500. It's the ground capacity. So.
Oh, do you go and follow Exeter?
Now and again, yeah, I do, yes.
Have you still got the cow shed there? I think that's what it was called, wasn't it?
That's where I grew up in my footballing interest, really, and watched Exeter play Man United was around about 1968. So, yeah, that's not there. That's now a proper stand, a seated stand, which is a bit more sensible.
Well, we've still got an hour's drive from Exeter to even get to civilization, haven't you, really? So, supporting the local clubs. I could talk to you all day about football. Better not. Question five. What has been your most embarrassing moment to date then, please, Frank?
I go back to when my daughter was about 8 months old. So, we're going back about just over 30 years now. And late afternoon, early evening, I was due to be helping out with the teenagers at the church group.
Mm-hmm.
I'd had a bit of time. My daughter was about 8 months old then. She loved this little rattle. It was sort of about a foot tall with a big clear globe on the top, but it had a sort of 3-inch sticker, so you could stick it on something and it would rattle and wobble and rattle. And she loved it. So I had her in my arms one day, just sort of rocking her and playing with her. And I thought, oh, great. So I grabbed the rattle and thinking, I've got it in both arms. What I'll do is I'll stick it to my head. Now, anyone with any common sense would realize that was not a good move. For a while, I had this sucker thing stuck to my head, and I'm shaking her head to rattle it so that, you know, she would engage with it. And I'd done that for about 20 minutes, and then I thought, I'm going to have to make a move in a moment. So I came to try and take it off, and that didn't go well. So I was left with this absolutely radiant, bright red, 3-inch round ring in the circle right in the middle of my forehead. And you can guess probably what the church youth group thought of that.
I'd be more interested if you had to go to work the following day and it was still there.
No, thankfully it was a Friday, so I had the weekend off. So, but there I was in front of this youth group with it was the summer as well, and with this great big glowing red ring right in the middle of my head. And as you can imagine, it really was a dumb end idea.
Something you wouldn't have done again, no doubt.
No.
Well, thank you for sharing those answers, Frank. Let's go into more important details now about yourself. Before we move on to part two of your life, what was it like growing up? Where did you actually grow up, sir?
I grew up in a small town called Topsham, just on the outskirts of Exeter. Quite an affluent little place, actually. Brilliant place for a kid to grow up. And the thing about Topsham was it was a very safe place, full of pubs. But one of the downsides was, as a kid, you couldn't get away with anything because everyone knew who you were. But it was a great place to grow up in, I must say.
You then go into the police. Why did you want to go into the police?
Well, before that, I was working local government at the council offices mm-hmm. in Exeter, but before that, at the county hall. And I was working in a department which was clerical. It was to service all the committees to make sure that all the councillors had all the right papers to read, the agendas, the minutes, etc. So, which for the first 12 months was okay. But then in the second year of that, it just got so tedious. And I just thought, oh, dear, 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 there's got to be something more exciting than this. But the good thing for me at the time was the council allowed me to go on a day release course doing an HNC in business, a public administration.
Uh-huh.
And on that course was a group of police cadets from the police headquarters, not far from where I live. So I got chatting to them, and I realized that the lives they were leading were so much more interesting than what I was doing. So one of them said to me, well, we've got some interviews coming up for new recruits. Why don't you give it a try? So I did. And as they say, the rest is history.
Yeah, slight difference from pen pushing in some ways, I suppose, to pen pushing in the police force and then some.
It was a complete culture change because I was just over 20 when I joined the police. I went to my first station. And it really was a complete difference of life, but it had the excitement that I was looking for.
Yeah, exactly. What excitement were you looking for then, Frank?
Something that was a lot more exciting than actually shifting bits of paper and then shifting other bits of paper and carrying them around. So I was looking for something that had a little bit of flair, that would be testing, a bit of excitement. You sort of tend to think of the fast cars, the blue lights and the basic things that might attract a 20-year-old. And that was it for me, really.
And did you get a chance to drive at 200,000 miles an hour and arrest the miscreant and everything else like that?
Not quite that fast, but yes. The short answer is yes, I did. Did all of it.
Wow. If I remember rightly, because we had a good chat a couple of days ago, you start off down in Cornwall. What was that like?
It was a good place to be for your first station. I was a uniform PC, so you had a tutor who took you under his wing for 10 weeks and then you were released to go solo. And it was quite good, but there wasn't too much happening. It was quite a quiet place, little Cornish market town, very quiet at the weekend, very quiet during the evening, but a little bit busy during the day. But it was a good grounding to learn the basics, really.
Was I right in saying that you're actually on the beat, you know, walking around the area?
Yeah, there was no such thing as a new probationer going in a car. You actually walked up and down for 8 hours. And this was actually, it didn't have any radios. So at every hour, on the hour, you'd be outside the telephone kiosk in the main town waiting for your sergeant to ring you to tell you what to do next or see how you were.
In like the Doctor Who telephone box?
No, it was just a public call box. So it reminds me of one day in particular, which was a Sunday afternoon, lovely summer's day. And a couple, elderly couple, walked up to me and they sort of looked me up and down. And there was only me there and the two of them. The place was deserted. And then the lady said to me in her American accent, gee, don't you guys carry guns? So I just looked around and said, what for?
Good answer.
the only person I could have shot was them. But said, no, we don't, and there's no need, really.
And that's how Bonnie and Clyde escaped. Yeah, it's a different type of policing, I would have thought. I mean, we hear in the press every so often, and other people just saying, oh, I wish we could go back to the days when the policeman would walk along on his beat instead of being in the panda cars. What's your take on that now?
There are definitely some benefits with that. You get to actually meet and talk to people in non-conflict situations. Otherwise, what tends to happen is you're dealing with a lot of people in a conflict situation.
Yeah.
And sort of neighborhood policing, the local policing, are actually getting around, walking around and meeting people, I think has been a great benefit, really.
So if you were Prime Minister, then maybe you'd put that out into all places and get more policemen on the beat. Would you do that?
There's always been the argument when I was in the police force of two things, really. Do we put our money into detection of crime or do we put it into the prevention? Yeah. If you put it into prevention, you'll have more people on the beat locally. If you're putting it into prevention, you'll have more people investigating crime, etc. And you have to come up with a balance between the two, and there isn't a perfect way of doing it.
Thank you. So, having enjoyed yourself down in Cornwall for a few years, you then go to Plymouth. Eventually, you end up in the train division, and obviously that speaks volumes for me because that's what I ended up doing as well, obviously not within the police force. But I can see a pattern coming up here now that, and hopefully we can major on this, is that God often looks at what you've done in the past so he can use it for the future. And all this groundwork that you've been doing in the police then moves you into what we can call, say, part two or even part three of your life. So tell me more what happened in your latter years in the police force and what you were then going to do next. What was going through your brain cells at that time?
Yeah. Okay. Well, can I just cover one point going from back from the earlier days?
Is that
as a brand new PC, once I was outside my 10-week tutorship period, you got sent to jobs on your own. And as a 20-year-old, I then began to see things that I hadn't seen before. And that was death. Because as a police officer, if there was a sudden death, you had to go along, attend, to make sure that there are no suspicious circumstances. Talking about life experiences, that formed a life experience for me, even at the age of 20. The experience it formed in my mind was that life is a privilege and not a right. And that stuck with me even right the way through my life. And it started when I was 20 years old through those circumstances. So that's a life experience for me, which has been etched into me, which affects the way I look at the world for the future.
That's a brilliant point you've just made then. Well, tell us more about why you think it's a privilege and not a right.
Because when you actually have to go around to houses of people and tell them that their son, their daughter, their mum, their dad, their husband isn't coming home today, I found it a difficult thing to do. It was very emotionally charged. And at the age of 20, I wouldn't say that we're all emotionally that well developed, really. That really made me think, because I'm seeing people that were not just elderly people, there were young people in car accidents, just suffering heart attacks at a young age, that were not coming home anymore. Mm. So I realized that age is, you know, youth is not, it's not a guarantee of long life at all.
My wife and I were watching New Tricks for the first time ever. I know it's a TV series. It was about 20 years ago. So we're playing catch up on BBC iPlayer, of all things. And literally a quote that we saw in one of the episodes the other day was that every policeman, because it's obviously a police series, detective series, every policeman remembers their first collar or their first murder. Let me ask you, what do you remember about your first time you had to go and see somebody about a death?
I can remember down at Liscard, being the young PC, saying in the first months of police service, and I got a call to go to this particular address, and I went there and I saw that a lady's husband had died. He was probably early 60s, and he had died, and he was up in bed. He just died in his sleep, and the local undertaker turned up, but he turned up on his own, and he asked me to come out and speak to him. So I sort of came out from the widow that I was speaking to, and said, yeah. And he said, look, I'm on my own today. He said, I haven't got no help. He said, would you help me carry the body out of the house? So we had like a coffin shell that he brought with him, but it was a very old building with almost like steps that are like a castle, very stone, curving, no handrails. And we had to, he was quite a heavy guy, so we actually bring him down from that. And that's the first time that I'd ever had sort of that hands-on experience. But in the early days as a police officer in your training, you were expected to attend postmortems so that you would actually see what was happening and how the medical examinations are needed, what the medical examiner needed, and what the coroner needed. So you were there watching the postmortems, which again makes you think.
Yeah, yeah. What do you remember the time when you obviously had to speak to the deceased widow?
I probably had about 12 months police service in this particular. Sorry, I'm going on to a slightly different situation. Was that I had another phone call when I was in Exeter to attend a lady's house and tell her that her husband had died at work as a result of a sudden death. By that time, I was, you know, I'd done this a few times. So I went round to the neighbour and actually spoke to her and said, look, do you know your next door neighbour well? She said, yes, I do. I said, look, I've got to tell her this is a situation. Would you come round with me? And she said, of course I will. So she came round and was obviously able to put an arm around her shoulder when I explained, look, this is a situation. And she would then continue to be with that lady when I had to leave. What stuck in my mind with this lady in particular was the dignity that she had. Shocking news. She was elderly herself, wasn't in the best of health. But the way she actually pulled herself together and said, okay, fine, thanks. Look, just give me a minute to get composed and get ready, please. She went and got changed. And the friend then helped take her to the hospital where she'd been asked to go. But just that dignity that she had and how she dealt with that, I thought, you know, brought tears to my eyes, really.
Yeah. To your credit, though, obviously from our background as a trainer, I'm a big believer in facilitating. And that's what you did. You went and got some help. Other people might have just gone and stormed in and got some bad news for you, but you actually saw the bigger picture, which is fantastic. And of course, that story can be used in all sorts of walks of life these days by just asking someone else to come with you. And in your training then, from what you've experienced in your first 30 years, what made you then say, right, I'm going to retire now, I'm going to go and do something else, such as CTN?
If I take you back to 3 years before I retired, so I had about 27 years police service by that time. I was inspector at the training college. I was the force training support manager. But I realised that I wasn't going to be in the police all my life. There were other things that I wanted to do, and they were training related, development related. So I thought, I've got a choice, really. I either stay here for a few years, good income, but a lot's demanded of you. But I really wanted to get involved with life coaching and training, because what happened to me was about 3 years before I was due to retire, a Christian businessman in the Exeter area was putting on a training course for Christians that might want to have their own businesses in the future. So he had his own businesses and was very well versed in the business world. There was about 20 of us on this particular course, and you went on one evening a week. It was the second evening of this course that I was going along, and a lady then who was brought in to speak, who was a life coach, and she asked me that question that you mentioned earlier. And that to me, that question she asked, which was, what has God put the unique you on this earth now to achieve? And I thought, I've been a Christian about 18 years. I was coming up 50 years of age. I thought, surely I should be to answer this question. But I couldn't. And that stopped me in my tracks. And that evening, I demanded of myself an answer. I said, you're going to answer this question. And I spent the next 5 months until I had that answer.
Now, that's interesting, because sometimes we say, oh, well, God never answers. And yet, if you look through the Bibles, as I have many a time now, realizing just how many times it says, wait. Just wait. And you've had 5 months to wait for your answer. So what were you doing in those 5 months, and how did the answer finally get revealed to you?
What I did during that 5 months was to actually, it drove me to seek God more intently and more earnestly. So I certainly upped my time in prayer with God and fellowship with God. And that was a key factor for me. Also, I had a clean sheet of paper. And that's one of the best things you can ever have, is a clean, simple sheet of paper. Because what I was looking at was the watts that I feel God had actually put within me to connect with. Because when I look back to Psalm 139, it's so clear that God knows us. You know, he says, I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. And he goes on to say, your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed, and in your book they were all written, the days fashioned for me, when as yet there were none of them. About how intimately God knows us, how individually and uniquely he knows us. And I had no doubt at all about our uniqueness. You know, the police service had taught me about fingerprints, DNA, identifying factors. There's so many that we are so totally unique. And when you add those life experiences to them, Martin, we are absolutely, totally unique. We see the world uniquely and we're in it uniquely. You know, the question then is obviously, why am I so unique? You know, God could have just cloned us all, couldn't we, to all like the same things, to do all the same things? Because the Bible talks about generic things for us to do as Christians. Feed the hungry, give drink to the thirsty, visit people in prison, clothe the destitute, the naked, helping people. Those are generic things which we are to do. And by generic, I don't demean them. They are very important things. But the question is, if we are created so intimately, why are we created so uniquely? And if you look at Ephesians 4, it goes on to say he himself gave some to be apostles, prophets, evangelists, some pastors or teachers, for the equipping of the saints, for the work of ministry, for the edifying of the body. All that uniqueness is for something, which is related to seeing the kingdom of God grow.
Mm.
And that was my question, is where's the unique bit, where I fit in? And that's why I started with a blank sheet of paper to think, God, what do you put on my heart to connect with?
And that's how it started.
That's how it started. And I got to the point where I had about half a dozen watts, things that I thought God had actually put on my heart to do.
Uh-huh.
And then the life coach lady said to us, if you get to that point, look to see if there's a link. Is there something that links those watts together? So there may not be, but if there is, the chances are it's your life mission.
Was she a Christian, this lady, as well?
Yes. Yes, she was.
Yeah, it's interesting that she was in her question, what has God put you on this earth for? Before we then find out exactly what happens, going just back a bit, still in your police force time, 27 years and then counting when you started to realise that maybe I have to do something else. You said there, but for like 18 years you were a Christian. What was it like being a Christian all of a sudden one day and having to go into the police force and say, well, actually, I'm a Christian now? What do you remember that time?
That was when I was on CID in Exeter. I was on what was called the burglary squad at that time. There weren't any other Christians on that particular unit, very close-knit unit. You know, you worked together, played together. But it was a question of work hard, play hard. So there was a lot of social drinking out after hours, et cetera, et cetera. One of the things that happened to me was that I was invited to church by a guy who was actually on the traffic department. He wasn't on CID at all. Well, he invited us to get to know him and his wife. We were invited around for a couple of meals, played squash together. Thankfully, he was even worse than I was. So that was quite enjoyable. He took the effort, took the time to build a relationship with myself and my wife. And I really value that. And I really thank him for it.
Yeah.
And then he did the dirty on me one day and said, would you like to come to church?
Disgusting.
So I went home to my wife and said, look, I don't want to let them down. You know, they're nice people, but what do we do? How do we get out of this without offending them?
Yeah.
And then she said, well, why don't we go? Now, what I didn't realize was that his wife had already been talking to my wife about the very same things and had invited her to church, which she'd said, you'll never get my husband to go. And it was through that time we went along, and we went along to the church and actually enjoyed it.
Wow.
And started listening to the minister. It was only a tiny little church, you know, sort of 30, 40, 50 people at most. And it was a brilliant family church and just really enjoyed it. And I got to the point where I was 30 years of age, or just coming up to 30, and I made that decision that Sunday afternoon to give my life to God.
So what was it like then when you had to go to work and say, well, actually, I'm a Christian? What do you remember that time?
Something happened overnight that rather startled me, really. That was I stopped swearing.
Really?
Yeah, I made no conscious effort to do that. It just happened. And if I did let out a swear word, it just grated with inside me. It was like, you know, like your nails being ripped down the blackboard. It just stopped me. Never tried to do that personally, but it just happened. And a few other things started happening. And one of the things that I did in particular at that time was to stop drinking. Came off beer completely for quite a few years. Now, that was what caused most of the interest.
Really?
Yeah.
Because?
Because people were interested. Well, why aren't you drinking anymore? Do you want a beer? No, thanks. I'll have a Coke or whatever. And party pooper, what are you doing? What's happened? that gave me the opportunity to actually tell them what had happened.
Yeah. It's interesting that you said for a few years. So obviously you do drink. I mean, I've made it known that I actually make my own beer and stuff like that. So what made you then decide to go back to drinking?
Because it was no longer a pull to me. You know, I said about working hard, playing hard.
Yeah.
So a lot of drinking outside of work. Sometimes you'd go straight onto the pub from work, depending on what shift you were working. So you were getting home later, you know, a couple hours and a little bit the worse for wear sometimes. But I like that. You know, it was quite stress relieving for me at the time, because it can be a bit stressful at time with all the stuff at work you got on. But after that period of time, it no longer had that demand on me to do it. And I was more than happy. If I drink 3 half pints of beer a year now, that's it.
But it's the pull. That's a great expression. It was the pull that was on you for that. And that's what you were cutting away from.
Yeah, I was cutting that part of my lifestyle out of my life.
Yeah, it wasn't, you're not saying, oh, I can't drink alcohol anymore. It was the lifestyle that was attributed to it.
Yeah, and I don't want to do it.
Yeah, very good answer.
I stuck with it. There was a bit of pressure, I must say, but I stuck with it. And in the end, it was accepted.
Just as a frivolous answer here from you, hopefully, people must have noticed that the way you would have gone in to have arrested somebody before you became a Christian, how did that change in the way you went about your job subsequently to becoming a Christian?
I think a bit more understanding, really, and a little bit more, I wouldn't say compassionate might not be the right word, but empathetic, to realise that people are in difficult situations. And some of the crimes that people are committing are, particularly in the lower income brackets, were actually in order to feed children. So I think I became a little bit more empathetic, I would say.
Oh, wow. All this is building up then. The experiences you've had, and God can use those experiences to when you finally decide to say, right, I'm going to call it a day. I've got those 5 watts. I think I now know what God is saying in between those watts as to what the whys are. So tell me more about the process and what actually happened.
Well, I looked at those watts and I'd take this pad of paper with me to work. And if I got a chance to have a lunch break, I'd sort of take that out and have a look at it. And first couple of times I looked at it and I looked at the watts. I thought, I can't see a link. And on the third or fourth occasion, I actually looked at it and I think, oh, yeah, there is a link here. And it's all about wanting to help people grow and develop, which is not surprising for someone's in training when you think about it. And that's when I realized that all these, you know, 10 years ago, when I got into training for the first time, I had this enjoyment of it without really realizing why. But it was like a fish taken to water, really. I really enjoyed it. But I looked at those list of watts and I thought, oh. So what you do then is once you've got an idea of what the linkage might be, you just try and pare it down to the very minimum, get out all the padding, the duplication, the waffle. And I came up with 23 words.
Which were?
To help people find their true place in God and to go on to release their full potential in Him and for Him. And there in 23 words is what I actually believe is my life mission, which has been one of the guiding factor or one of the main guiding factors ever since.
Wow. So how many years ago are we talking about when this took place?
20 years ago.
So you've now got, I suppose, your mission statement in 23 words. It's great. Then what happens next? So what did happen next then, Frank?
Well, I had to look at what I could do. Bear in mind, it's helping people find their true potential.
Yeah.
And one of the things that happened to me and my colleague, Barry Townsend. Barry was a retired director from the motor trade, lives in Exmouth, you know, not far from Exeter, where I was at the time. And we got to know each other through the Full Gospel Businessmen's Fellowship.
Uh-huh.
And what happened then was we started coming into contact with Christians that had their own businesses or were in business, and they didn't know each other. And it's fair to say that the business world can be quite lonely and quite stressful at times.
Yes.
So we started then connecting business people together. And that's when CTN, Crosslink, as we called it at the time, was formed. And the idea was to connect, encourage and support Christians in the workplace in their Christian faith, really. So since then, the network has grown, but we meet on Zoom. So we do get some people joining us from, say, New Zealand and some other countries. That's when we started that network to connect people, to help them be the best they can be in business. But after a while, we found that we got the social side of that well, of connecting people together, but there was a bit of a frustration. And when we looked at it, we wanted to see not just the social side of it, but we wanted to see Christians having an impact on the business world in their workplaces and the culture that was happening around them. So we changed the title from Crosslink to Crosslink Transformation Network. We put the T in there for a specific purpose, and we started bit by bit to change from just learning about business and helping each other in business to actually really being a Christian in business and how God wants us to partner with him in the workplace. Because to me, the workplace is the lost mission field, it's the missing mission field.
Going back to your mission statement then, let's say you had it put on the wall, came up with it on a Tuesday night, and then Wednesday morning, right, today's the first day of the rest of my life. I've got my mission statement. It's great. But you then have to put the first step forward and actually go and see somebody or contact somebody. So what process did you use? What actually happened?
I went to Indianapolis.
Okay, which is just down the road a bit.
Yeah. Basically, what it was, I'd retired, I'd had this little lump sum, and I was able to, I had the time and the resources. And you hear me read in the book, I talk about the three T's. That's our time, our talent, and our treasure. And God has given us the three T's to use in what he's equipping and calling us for. Mm-hmm. At that time, I've been doing a lot of training stuff within the police force, as you can imagine, being a training manager and the force training support manager.
Yeah.
But one of the things I'd actually picked up on the time was an organization called Gallup, and they had what was called Strengths Finder.
Gallup as in the survey company.
Yes. Yeah, they started off as a survey polling company, but they quickly changed to leadership and management, and that's most of what they do now.
Oh, really? I always remember Gallup from the 70s, because they always used to put the top 40 together. That's how I remember them.
Yeah, but one of the things they devised was an online assessment, about 80 questions, it takes about 10 minutes, and it identifies for you your top five strengths. Because I found that so useful, even in the last sort of, you know, I'd learnt about it around about the 3 years before I left, started getting interested in it, and then wanted to know more. Well, at the time, Gallup had their secular side, but they also had a faith division, which was based in Indianapolis. So I took myself on a plane, went over there and did a short training course with them. And that, again, highlighted to me the absolute uniqueness. But it was very handy for me to know my top five strengths, because I couldn't have told you what they were, but now I could. I knew what each one meant, and I know how they fitted together.
Yeah.
That was part and parcel of the life coaching that I was doing at that time. And I'd already, by that time, drafted out Gateway to Destiny.
Which we'll talk about in a minute, yeah.
Yeah, I was teaching it in a small way.
You see, what's great about that is you put your money where your mouth was, really, didn't you? Just fly over to Indianapolis. As I jokingly said, it's just down the road by about 3,000 miles, you know, and you've just got a little pond to go across. The number of times you must have met, as I've met, where people are at that crossroads in life, they maybe hadn't done their kind of mission statement that you've done, but it does involve a time, I would have thought, whereby actually now, you know, you've got to fly your colours. You've got to take whatever little money you've got and put it forward. What do you remember of that time where, you know, for instance, just paying out for the money to go to the Indianapolis and all the other people saying, well, is that a really good idea and all that sort of stuff?
Life is a privilege and not a right. And that's that life view that stuck with me. And that's what got me interested in life coaching. It's funny enough, I went over to India as well with our local church group. We went into Mumbai and then Bangalore and then Chennai. And we met different Christian congregations there. And I had to smile because we were at this pastors' conference, which had about 200-300 local pastors. Some of them had taken 2 to 3 days walking to get there.
Wow.
Very humbling.
Yeah.
They opened up in song. They were all singing in their local dialect. I could not understand a single word of what they were saying. It was like someone had set fire to a group of cats. But every now and again, I heard one word, Jeevan, Jeevan. It's the only word I could actually understand. So I said to the local person, what's Jeevan? He said, it means life. So I thought, there's something of significance in the word life to me, which is going back to the life coaching. And again, it made me think I need to push on and answer that question, because the days of my life are going by. They've been already ordained by God. I've just got to connect with him to find out what they are. And that's why I started writing the Gateway to Destiny, which was how I then came to answer that question.
Yeah, well, let's talk more about the book then. What processes did you have to go through in order to write the book and then get it published?
There was an 18-year gap between starting it and finishing it.
I got that feeling.
Yeah. I just started writing things on paper. I looked at the process that I went through of how I actually got asked that question and how I started to answer it. But I started to teach it out to a few people from the church and others nearby. And it almost came to be a sort of so what experience. I've done this. Mm. I've identified some whats. And that's as far as it was going with some people, whereas others were actually starting to really get engaged with it. I called it Gateway to Destiny because the gate stands for what's G-A-T-E, Giants, Arrows, Targets and Eagles. And I start with giants rather than going in straight to find your whats, because you have to set a foundation where people will want to go on to do something with it once they've identified what those whats were, which wasn't happening in the first round of training that I did. That was quite a fascinating process, really. I realized that you actually have to get people to confront themselves, really, is to the subtitle to the book, I should say, is Your Life and What You're Doing With It. And bear in mind, I was 48 years old. I've been a Christian 18 years, etc. So a lot of my life had already gone by. And I'd had that question asked to me in different forms previously in my Christian life. And it just went straight over my head. I never engaged with it. But this time, at that age, it just grabbed me. So I started actually thinking, I look back on the process I went through of actually getting a blank sheet of paper, how to identify the whats, but then how to break them down so they were much more detailed. Because sometimes you can come up with just the gist of something, like homelessness, working with the homeless, or one that I came up with in particular was coming alongside the lonely. An experienced Christian, they'd had that for years and years in their life. That's what I want to do. And so, well, what are you doing with it? Well, nothing. Why? Because I don't know what it is. I don't know what it means. So I sat down with that particular person, and within a couple of hours, they could tell you who the lonely were, what getting alongside them meant, what the needs were that they wanted to meet, because there's so many different needs you can meet, spiritual, emotional, physical, a whole lot of different needs. But then who do you want to work with? What's your target group? What age? What profile are they? Are they business owners? Are they prisoners? Are they men? Are they women? Have they got abilities? Have they got disabilities? So by actually trying to get clarity and bringing some focus to it, that helps people overcome the sort of so what side of things, where, yes, I know my whats and they don't do anything about them. So the giant side is actually identifying what is stopping you and holding you back from connecting with the things that God's put on your heart that he's created you for. So that's why giants was the first section, because we have to overcome that. And if we think there aren't any giants, then why is it that I was 48 years into life before I answered the question? Because there were things that were stopping me.
And I think one of the big things would be, for instance, well, I want to do this, and I'm thinking of a particular previous podcast guest, and he achieved so much. And he wanted to do so much, but it was as if that there was a big giant in a way, and that was the giant of finances. And how often does this crop up with you? Maybe not yourself personally, but when you explain this to other people, they're saying, yes, but I need to have income first. I need to make sure my family's okay.
Yeah, I do cover that in the book, really. What I say to people is, when you're identifying your whats, you've got a green light now. Write down anything that you feel God's put on your heart to connect with. Do not filter anything out by reason of your three T's. Don't take any notice of the fact that it's going to take days, weeks, months of your life or your finances or anything else. Just green light it and then review your whats later on. One of the most key ones I come up with is time. Uh-huh. I haven't got the time to do this. Do you know what I say to that?
And the reason I'm laughing is because as a training officer, we used to train at length to explain how to overcome objections. And there was always normally three answers. And the first one is time. So, yes, that's why I was smirking. So tell me what your response would be, please.
My answer is you do have the time. So what I would say to everyone is, when it comes to time, you have the same as me, which is 24 hours in a day. The only difference is what you choose to do with it. That's the difference. And when you look at people that are high performing in their secular occupations, even those within Christian ministry, if you want to use that term, high performing,
yeah,
it's because they're prioritizing what they're doing with their time.
Exactly.
And that's one of the key things. Another big hindrance was that people have, I've just got the gist of something, like this other person coming alongside the lonely. They've not been able to go through a process that's made that clear to them. It didn't take very long talking to that particular person, so they knew what need they wanted to work with, which was spiritual and physical. And they also knew the group that they wanted to work with. And that made life easier. But also then you've got to start looking at when you know one of your whats, you have to break it down, action planning, so that there's nothing stopping you from taking the first step. If it's too big a hurdle, you'll never get started, which is what, again, I'm covering in the giant section, really.
I don't want you to give too much away because I'd love people to actually buy the book. You personally, though, Frank, having written the book, apart from the millions of pounds that you've got from royalties from selling the books, what did you get out of it?
A real closer connection with God and peace. Being at peace with myself because I know what I'm here for. And I know that I'm working towards that purpose that I have, that my life, which is a privilege and not a right, is doing the things that I believe God wants me to do. And that brings a sense of peace with it. Once I came to the point where I realized my whats and my life mission, I realized, and I mentioned in the book, that I really had reached a critical point. I'd broken each of the whats down, so I knew what was the first step to take to start achieving each of them.
Mm.
The point I'd actually got to was I realized I come to the point where there is no excuse now not to push on, because I'd done all the work. I'd spent that time with God. I knew the key things of what he wanted me to do. I knew how to start. The only thing that was stopping me from starting, if you go back to the giants, would be my will. And that's where I have to make a decision. Will I invest my three T's in what I believe God's given me to do? And the way I look at that is an archery target.
Mm-hmm.
You can probably visualize one now with a sort of white outer border. It's got a black outer ring, and then it goes different colors until you get to the gold in the center. And if you take each year of your life as an arrow, then the question I ask is, are you hitting your life targets? Are you actually hitting what God has put you here to do? And one of the sort of crucial aspects of being a life coach is to help people avoid having regrets later in life. This is why we've got the arrow section. Unless we see ourselves as an arrow in God's hand, it says in Isaiah, he made me to be an arrow, a polished arrow, which he hid in his quiver. We're meant to be articles for warfare, spiritual warfare, for God to fire us into situations where we can make the biggest impact for the kingdom of God. And up until, well, I was 48 years of age, so I've been a Christian for 18 years, where had my arrows been hitting? And to be fair, not too many had been hitting in the target. And then the question for me is, well, how long do you want that to continue? Do you actually want to hit those life targets? Because what I've realized was that when you're working in your gold center, the fulfillment comes with it. You know, going back to me finding that life was too boring in the clerical department in County Hall, it's because there was no fulfillment in it for me. There was in the police force, and there is for us in our life when we serve God, doing what he calls us to do. We get the fulfillment that comes with it.
But you see, nothing is wasted, is it? Because your 12 months of pen pushing at County Hall would have taught you a bit about paperwork, because I've just got a feeling that in the police force, there's quite a bit of paperwork, especially when you've arrested a miscreant, for instance. That wasn't wasted. And likewise, God then used you to do what you had to do within the police force to move on to the next step. For anyone that's listening at the moment, that's at that crossroads, in the remaining, let's say, 1 minute, what would you say to that person?
Get close to God. Get that blank sheet of paper and ask God to show me what are the things that you've already put in me that I can connect with. And then just start to write them down on it. Give time to it. Seek God over it. And just do it. And once you've got those things down, then you can actually start to look at it and look at how to action it and put it together. But the fact is, if you don't, do you want to spend the rest of the years of your life and in the end end up saying, I never hit my life targets. I never found out or did what God wanted me to do. Because if you remember going back to the Bible, it says about producing fruit at 30, 60, 100% return on the investment that God's put in us. And I think God does want a return, an investment in the unique life he's given us. But unless we connect with it, break it down so we understand it and start doing it, we're missing the key things that answers that question of what have you been put, the unique you've been put on this earth now to achieve. And I think that's the question we don't want to miss.
Exactly. And for me personally, listening to that, I know that from the age of 3, all I ever wanted to be was a radio presenter. And I went a long way around to get to it. But I can look back in my life now and say, look, I did what I wanted to do. And I really believe that's what God wanted me to do as well. So, yeah, I'm just hoping that people in their latter years don't look back and say, oh, if only I'd done that, that's what I really wanted to do, because it's never too late, is it, to change tack?
No, it isn't. And that, you know, when I said that I came to that life mission,
yeah,
and I, in 23 words, I could answer what it was. Shortly after that, I read Ephesians 1, verse 1 again. And I'd always read that as just a general introduction of Paul to the Ephesian church. But he says 11 words, Paul, an apostle of Christ Jesus by the will of God. And when I read that this time, I thought, I get it. What he's written down in 11 words is his life mission. He knows who he is, Paul. He knows whose he is, of Christ Jesus. He knows what he is, an apostle, and he knows that he's in the will of God. And when I just realized the total transformation that had come about for him and how much had been stripped out of his life in order to focus on just that, I was amazed. I thought, wow, I really see that focus that he's had and how he has been transformed and 100% committed to what God's called him to do. And I just thought that was amazing. I'd love to ask him about it.
Well, hopefully I can organize it for you on that one with my time machine. We'll bring him back. I don't know how good you are in the language of Greek, Hebrew maybe as well. So we might have to get a translator, but hey.
Yeah, as long as he's not an Argyle supporter, I'll be happy.
I was waiting for that. As I found out you're an Exeter City fan. For those that want to contact you today or know more about getting the book, you must have a website, so please tell me about that.
Yeah, it's www.gatewaytodestiny.com. So that's www.gatewaytodestiny.com.
And where's the book available?
It's on Amazon. Apparently it's in 14 countries. But I really want to get people enthused in finding God's plan and purpose for their life. And if you've got people out there who've got a training gift, Christians with a training gift who want to go through this, get yourself a copy. Start training other people in it. Start taking through the same thing as you've been through. Your house group, your life group, or anyone else that might be interested.
Well, here's the thing. It took 18 years to write. When was the book finally released?
It was released in February this year. And the reason for that in particular was that the last section is called Eagles. And it talks about overcoming, but it really talks about the journey from convert to disciple. And it took me quite a while to realize that I'd become a convert, but I hadn't actually really pushed on to become a disciple until later in my Christian life. And that whole section, the closing section, was something that I finished recently. And that's what really made me finalize that last section and then get it printed.
And for those that want to know more about you becoming a disciple, they'll just jolly well have to buy the book, won't they?
They will.
Or wait until the film comes out. I don't know, some famous film star playing you. Frank, got to ask you now then, final question, drum roll please. Thank you so much for what you've shared. I hope it's been as much an encouragement to others as it has been to me today. So thank you so much for that. And I look forward to hearing from people in the years to come as to, well, this is what I've done as a result of the book. But in the meantime, Frank Bennett, who is your Christian hero, please?
Yeah, I thought about that one, but it didn't take me very long either on that one, Martin. My Christian hero really has been Reinhard Bonnke, the German evangelist. Just a man that to me was totally sold out to God. But particularly what I liked was that God gave him a dream. Going back to your dreams in God and actually finding out what they are and partnering with God to achieve them. God told him that Africa will be saved, and how he then devoted his life to that. He moved to Africa, him and his wife, and they moved to Africa, and they tried building a church, and it would get up to 50, and then it would dwindle down. It would get up to 80, and he spent a lot of years of his life in those early days, and it seemed to be coming to so little, and he was crying out to God, saying, God, why is it so hard? So in effect, what was he doing? He was complaining. He was complaining to God, and he took a drive out into the wilds, and he got out of his car, and he was stood on a bridge over a very, you know, giant gorge. And the gorge was just a completely dry riverbed that had, and he described it as thistles, the height of a man, as far as you could see. And bear in mind what he'd been saying to God is, God, it's been so hard. Why is it hard, etc. And he's there looking down on this dryness and the obstructions and the thorns and the thistles. And there was a rumble in the distance, and he thought, oh, what's that noise? And then a huge torrent of water just filled the gorge that he was looking at. So it was so violent. There'd obviously been a flash flood up in the hills.
Yeah.
This torrent came down and it tore up every single one of those thistles and filled the dry gorge with water. And God was saying, That's my transformational power. That's what I can do. And Bonnke was heartened by that, and he took it as a sign from God, and he started back with his ministry with new vigor, and they saw hundreds of people come into God. They saw thousands, tens of thousands, and at one meeting, they estimated they had 1 million people at one meeting. And what just struck with me was how he had overcome, how he'd gone from accepting the challenge to overcoming the giants, having the faith in God, and seeing Christ for All Nations, you know, a massive movement that affected not just a town, not just a city, not just a country, but a whole continent for God. So much so they're having to bring lorries into the meetings to take away the crutches of the lame people that didn't need them anymore.
Mm.
How the blind were seeing, how the deaf were hearing, and how the dead were being raised. But other than that, Martin, nothing to it really, is there?
Piece of cake, isn't it?
Yeah, what's the difficulty?
It goes back to the mustard seed. It's a conversation my wife and I have had from time to time as well. And why is Africa seeing all these great miracles and we in the UK and elsewhere in the Western world not? Is it to do with faith and the lack of faith? What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to do with that. And I also think that we have an awful lot of giants of being well off, the giants of having a job, the giants of having income and not having to actually look around for every piece of food that we need for our next meal for us and our families.
Yeah.
Because Cole had a great way for it, really, and said about the persecuted church is that over here in the West, we're pretty much playing at it, really.
I remember just had become a Christian, actually, and in our Bible study that day, we had someone from Japan come over, a missionary on furlough, and the basic premise of it was that China was seeing incredible persecution. This is back in the 1980s. But the Christians that could actually get together and pray together were praying for the persecution in the West, that we would get persecution so we could truly find Christ.
Yeah. Yeah. One other thing, if I could ask you, is any Christian listeners that know of other people, Christians in other parts of the world that might be interested in finding God's plan and purpose for life, please send them a link or get them to contact me. I'd love to have more contacts in other countries in the world, so that we can start actually getting a whole lot of people just trained up and enthused into what God's got for them internationally, really.
Get onto the website straight away, www.gatewaytodestiny.com, because there is a contact us part on there.
Yeah.
And so they can get hold of you that way. Frank Bennett, thank you so much for what you shared today. I'm as encouraged, hopefully, as everybody else who's been listening today is as well, and that they will want to contact you. Thank you so much for joining us today. Cheers.
Right. Thanks, Martin. Really appreciate it.
Next time on Off-Grid Christianity.
I think the important thing is you've got to be seen to walk the talk. One of the things my children said to me is that one of the most powerful things was that when I was first diagnosed with cancer, they said there was this incredible peace that I seemed to emanate. I remember my husband as well, who is not as deep of faith than mine. He said, when we first went in to see the oncologist and he told me the prognosis, he said, there was this extraordinary sense of calm descended upon you. And he said, I know it didn't come from you because you could worry the leg off a table. And it's that kind of that we're living in a way, it's almost counterintuitive. So I think one of the most important things is our words must match our actions. If we say that we've experienced the peace of God, we need to demonstrate the peace of God. If we say that we have found Christ, we need to be able to show how he's showing up in our lives, as well as being able to talk about it.
So please join me for a special podcast on how we can share our own soul story with returning guest, the author and broadcaster, Kate Nicholas. Until then, cheerio.